We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. Today we are talking about the Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and beyond. Welcome to Potterversity. Today we are talking with Lana Whited about her new book, The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, author of several Harry Potter essays and co-editor of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
Today we are talking with our dear friend and longtime Harry Potter scholar, Dr. Lana Whited, about her latest anthology, The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond. Really cool, thick book with lots of great essays in it.
Yes.
Emily, my question to you is this. Why does so much Harry Potter scholarship end up in anthologies, do you think? I feel like we tend to communicate with each other via essays in books that are anthologies. Why do we do that?
Yeah, you know, I haven't really thought about it that way, but I guess you're right. I have a lot more Harry Potter anthologies on my shelf than I do like single author volumes on Harry Potter. But I'm thinking about a lot of stories from academics that I've heard, and I would say, including you, Katie, that the Harry Potter series gave them kind of something fun and interesting to do academically, you know, that was a little bit apart from their regular discipline, but really fit right into it and kind of helped even maybe revive their interest, you know, in areas of their own discipline. And so I think that Harry Potter and because I know there's a lot of pop culture anthologies out there. And I think that a lot of scholars of various disciplines find a little bit of release in being able to sort of, I wouldn't say dabble in these worlds, but sort of play academically in these worlds, creating rigorous scholarship, but that is kind of honed into this one outlet of these, you know, a particular franchise like Harry Potter or Star Wars or Star Trek. So I think that's it. I think maybe the other thing is that we love to be, you know, we academics love to be in community with each other and to have kind of a communal space to dialogue. And as much as an anthology is kind of prepared, you know, individually, we do sometimes get opportunities to come together and to discuss, you know, how the essays within them speak to each other. But so those are my initial thoughts.
I like the second thing that you said particularly, and I have found that to be true, that when you're engaged in an anthology with other people, it does tend to create community. And mm-hmm. it's part of that Harry Potter ACAFAN group mm-hmm. that I think we're a part of. I also think there may be something to the fact that for a while it was actually hard to get Harry Potter scholarship accepted in academic journals. And so I think anthologies became a good place for people who wanted to do that research to do it and not have to face the, you know, why are we talking about this, you know, this thing, right? That's just mm-hmm. popular, or it's just for children, or it's just silly, or it's magical. And you didn't have to fight that battle with, you know, the loftier journal editors, and you could instead be a part of a community of people who already accept that the books are worth talking about.
Right. No, yeah, I agree with that. In fact, I mean, I I think there are still journals that are. I was just warned off a journal by another Harry Potter scholar the other day. I said, "Oh, should I submit to such and such journal?" And he said, "Well, you know, I don't think they're going to take anything like that." And so I'm kind of like, "What year is it?" You know?
I know. You would
I might
think.
submit anyway, just to test the theory, just to say. And then if they reject me, I can blame it on that.
That sounds good to me. That sounds fair. I believe that that's probably very, I believe that would be accurate, right?
Yeah, totally, totally.
I also think that there's a real advantage with these anthologies in having a lot of cool Harry Potter essays, sometimes on particular themes, in one place. And so get your hands on a good anthology and you have a lot of Harry Potter scholarship. And a lot of the people who are interested in Harry Potter scholarship are interested in all the Harry Potter scholarship, you
Oh,
know, not
yeah.
just on a particular topic or angle or, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are just game readers for all that. And I certainly am. I like an anthology. And actually, one of the first ways I encountered Harry Potter scholarship was in Lana Whited's original Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, which I used
Yep.
my Elfin Mystique first Harry Potter essay that I composed. And I was amazed and excited to see that there was already an anthology, and I devoured all the parts of it. And it was very useful to me to have that and to have it in one book. And so, yeah.
I see it cited so often too. You
Me
know,
too.
it's one of those fundamental texts that, you know, new Harry Potter scholarship really can't ignore. And it's always a thrill. It's
And
always a
isn't it
thrill.
interesting how it managed to hit on a lot of areas that end up being still talked about and contentious and still things that we want to discuss?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So without further ado, today we are going to talk with Dr. Lana Whited about the Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond. Dr. Whited is professor of English and director of the Boone Honors Program at Ferrum College in Virginia. She edited the first anthology of Harry Potter scholarship back in 2002, The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter from University of Missouri Press, as well as volumes in the Critical Insights series on the Harry Potter series and the Hunger Games trilogy. She's also written the book Murder in Fact, Disillusionment and Death in the American True Crime Novel. That's from McFarland, 2020. And her most recent book, my gosh, Lana, you just are producing so much scholarship. But her most recent book is this revisiting of the world of Harry Potter scholarship some 20 years down the line, The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond, also put out by University of Missouri Press in 2023. Welcome back to the show, Lana.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all those lovely things that you said about the Ivory Tower and Harry Potter. And just to throw in a comment about your discussion about anthologies, you know what I like best about anthology projects is working with all the people that you get to meet along the way. An anthology is a group project. You know, it's like a
Yeah.
team of people putting a book together, and that's the thing I like best about it. And if I were a book publisher, I would also like the fact that in addition to the reputation of the editor, you also get the reputation of all the contributors. And boy, when I look at the table of contents of this book, I'm impressed with the number of people like present company and also John Granger and Bea Groves and Louise Freeman and Elizabeth Hardy and Patrick McCauley, people who have books of their own and have just been huge in Harry Potter scholarship. So.
Yeah, I agree. It's an impressive table of contents, and there are so many wonderful scholars. I know that you also work to include younger scholars as well as, you know, the more seasoned scholars. And that's great. I think it creates a really rich volume that shows you a lot of the variety of where that scholarship is coming from. But
Yeah.
Lana, why did you decide this was a good time to revisit Harry Potter scholarship? Why produce the Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond?
I had to go back and look at my timeline really to think about that. I was thinking that I first got that idea around the time I started attending the Chestnut Hill Conference, but that turned out not to be the case. I actually went to the Chestnut Hill Conference for the first time in October after I started working on this anthology in June. What happened was that I was involved in that Harry Potter festival that was happening in Roanoke, Virginia, near me, which in its second year became Generic Magic Festival as a way of avoiding the Harry Potter copyright and trademark issues. We had our first conference in May of 2017, and you guys were a part of of those festivals as well. We had our second conference in October of 2018. And I think those festivals, as much as anything else, caused me to start thinking about areas of Harry Potter scholarship that were unexplored, as well as the fact that there was very little scholarly attention to other works by Rowling. And it also occurred to me that the 25th anniversary of the publication of Sorcerer's Stone would be coming up in 2021. And I liked the idea of trying to get out a book in connection with the 25th anniversary of the start of the series. As it turned out, it took a few more years than that to actually get the book finished and get it out there. But it had a whole lot to do with that. And the other thing I think that was a factor and that sort of amuses me when I think about it, you mentioned the only monograph I've written, the Murder, in Fact book, which is about American true crime novels. I was getting ready to send off the manuscript of that to my editor in June of 2019 when I started working on the book that became The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond. I was just getting ready to send off that manuscript. And one thing I don't really do well is not have a book project or a writing project of some sort in process. And actually, even before I sent off that manuscript, I distracted myself by drafting a call for proposals and sending it off to a couple of places, putting it out on social media, just to go ahead, you know, go ahead and get another boat in the channel, so to speak, before I sent off that manuscript, because I had the sense that I was ready to start working on something new.
I understand that. I feel that I can feel that too in myself. And sometimes when you're coming to the end of something, to begin again, it's refreshing and it, you know, it all the possibilities and it can be really exciting.
And it is refreshing. And keep in mind, I've been working on a monograph, and a monograph is a very, very solitary kind of project compared to everything I just said about, you know, an anthology project. It's almost like the difference between playing a team sport and playing an individual sport. The anthology project is like, you know, being on the soccer team or being on the basketball team or something like that. A monograph is more like golf or tennis or, you know.
Yeah, and you're like the team captain on the volleyball team or what have you, right? Because you're also, you're doing all this kind of organizing and structuring and liaison type kind of things. And that has its own joys, I think.
Lana, how, reflecting back on both of your Harry Potter anthologies, how is your approach to this new book, The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond, different from your original approach to The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter?
I think the early part was faster, although in both cases, with both books, I had a contract right away. I mean, I've told the story about the original book so many times, which essentially was that I gave my first Harry Potter paper at a conference in Roanoke, Virginia. The Children's Literature Association was meeting there. It occurred to me on the way home that there was not an anthology of essays about the Harry Potter series yet, and there were only three books out at that time. Goblet of Fire was released during the publication period for that anthology. But it occurred to me then, and I went home immediately and wrote query letters to six or eight publishers asking, would you be interested in an anthology of essays about the Harry Potter series? I sent those out on Monday in June 2020. And on Friday of that week, an editor at the University of Missouri Press called me on the phone at home. And he said, have you signed a contract for that Harry Potter book yet? And I thought, you know, I've never published a book before, but I don't think this is how it happens. I think it's supposed to take a really long time. And, you know, I had published a few journal articles and I knew that the peer review publication process was lengthy. So I had the benefit in both cases of knowing from the beginning that the book was going to be published. With this second book, I sent out and posted a CFP in lots of places and signed a contract with Missouri by the beginning of that month. I think I signed the contract on June 18th or something like that. So I had that advantage. With the first book, one thing that was really different is I think I didn't have the confidence in my selections that I did the second time around. The first time, I asked my sister-in-law, who was on the English faculty at Catawba College in North Carolina, to read all the proposals and rank them for me. And essentially, as I recall, I think we ranked them into three categories: definitely, maybe, and probably not. So she ranked those. I had Katherine Grimes, who is also a contributor to both anthologies, do the same thing. I got a lot of input from other people as to the proposals and what went in, what went out. The second time around, I did it all myself, with the exception of maybe just a few things that I was uncertain about. I may even have asked the two of you to read a couple of things during that process. I think my approach was just a little more confident, and I trusted myself more to make those choices at that point. Yeah, so that's probably the biggest difference. The other thing is, and this is probably obvious, that I had decided this was not going to be an essay, a collection of essays just about the Harry Potter series, but also about the other works that Rowling has published, the Fantastic Beasts series, the Casual Vacancy, on which at the time that I was starting out, there was absolutely nothing in the way of a peer-reviewed article. The Cursed Child, the Ichabod came out while the work was in progress. And I actually changed my own essay. I'll talk about that a little later on. I was planning to write about something else. In fact, I think the essay I was planning to put in The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond may be the one that is now published in your Potterversity book. I think it was the one about dragons and phoenixes.
Yeah, I think so. I'm glad we got it.
Yeah, right. Everyone wins.
Yeah, I decided when the Ichabod came out that I wanted to include that instead because it would, that way we would have another work by Rowling in the anthology.
Yeah, it's just amazing to think of putting together an anthology on a series that wasn't even out yet, you know, that it was just the fourth book was coming out as you were in publication. It was like,
Pretty comfortable taking that sort of risk. I don't think I would have ever been comfortable publishing the kinds of books that John Granger was putting out at that point when he was literally making predictions about the plots of, developments in the forthcoming volumes. I don't think I'd be very confident doing that.
I've never liked making predictions because I just hate being wrong, and I usually am when I'm making predictions.
I think during the course of the series coming out, I only ever made one prediction that I actually was confident enough about to publish. And that was that there would be a time when Draco Malfoy would be asked to do something huge, some big gesture, and that he would not be capable of doing it.
That's a good one, Lana.
Thank you. And his lack of capability for doing that would demonstrate that he's not completely bad, that there were some aspects of him that might demonstrate a little bit of restraint. And so when Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince came out, I thought, yeah, I got that one right, I think.
Hey, I might argue that it's also maybe his child outcomes from his the parenting model that was used on him, but we'll get there.
We'll
We'll
get
get there.
there. We'll get there. Yeah, so one of the things that I think is delightful about having these two volumes, the one in 2002 and the other one in 2023, almost 20 years later, just a little more than 20 years later, is that we can get a sense of what's happened in Harry Potter scholarship over the last 20 years. And you actually do address that in your introduction, which I think is a really invaluable survey of, what's been going on in the last 20 years. So what do you think, Lena, is the value of a retrospective like that? And how would you characterize the development of Harry Potter studies over the last 20 years?
Well, I'm really glad you think that's valuable. I confess that at the time I sat down to write the introduction, Rowling World had imploded by that time. And I remember kind of
Oh,
starting
yeah.
out and thinking, what do I say here and how to approach the task of writing the introduction. I hope it's valuable for readers to think about the way that, first of all, just to think about Harry Potter studies as an area of scholarship. That in and of itself, I think, is very important. And one of the most exciting things for me about participating in it has been the way that it is always evolving, and changing. I mean, I think about people who do Shakespeare studies, for example, are basically dealing with something that has been in progress over like more than 400 years now. And that's kind of intimidating in a different way, I guess, than some of the things that we've said today. In terms of important changes along the way, I certainly think that early on, there were a lot of people chiming in from a lot of different academic disciplines, and that made clear right away that this was going to be a literary series that was going to be appealing way beyond literary studies, traditional kind of narrow realm of peer-reviewed scholarship, which tends to stay within its discipline, I think, for the most part. I think also I noticed early on that a lot of people who maybe were not traditionally in the audience for reading literary criticism were interested when the Ivory Tower and Harry Potter came out. You know, I had young people I knew who were Harry Potter fans in some cases were reading it. So I think it reached a much broader audience also. So early on, as I said, there were lots of approaches from different disciplines, lots of books looking at Harry Potter from the standpoint of science and technology and history and law and psychology, philosophy, all these different areas. Took a little while for the books to be forthcoming because obviously that process takes a little bit longer. But even by the time the series ended, there were at least three or four pretty well-known. Giselle Anatole did a couple of those anthologies. More recently, I think that the innovation of podcasting has really allowed some growth in Harry Potter studies. And I really credit the Harry Potter series to some extent for the explosion of the kinds of podcasts that involve discussion of literature. When I wrote the introduction, I did specifically look to see how many Harry Potter related podcasts I could find. And there were far more than on any other single work or series, any literature by an individual author. I think podcasting has benefited Harry Potter studies, but Harry Potter studies has also benefited podcasting.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they kind of are, Harry Potter scholarship and podcasting are kind of happening simultaneously. And you've talked about like MuggleNet Academia. MuggleNet was kind of early on in some of those podcasts, and hopefully ours is a descendant of podcasts like that, so that you are creating these spaces where fans can participate in and listen to conversations about the literature that they love and that is meaningful to them.
The overlap of the Harry Potter series coming out and podcasting is one of those happy accidents of the sort that Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his book Outliers. It's kind of like the phenomenon of people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, all those folks being born around the right time in the mid-1950s, so that right at the time that they were, you know, heading to college and choosing fields of study, computer science became a possibility. Mm-hmm. And that accounts largely, I think, that timing for their success. So yeah, I think the timing of that was really fortunate. I say in the introduction, I think that I believe that Harry Potter studies is broadening and branching. And I think that's true. I think there are areas of scholarship. One good example is there's a fair amount of scholarship, as you know, on the situation of the house elves in the Harry Potter series. A fair amount of figurative ink has been devoted to that. And you know, you might think that someone like me would be hesitant to choose another essay on that topic, but Alyssa Lowry's essay in the Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond really kind of takes a different approach in that a lot of that previous writing talks about the house elves situation in the context of North American slavery. Alyssa's thesis is largely that that is a kind of reductive and non-productive way to talk about the house elves, and it's much more interesting to talk about them in terms of labor movements and enfranchisement and other kinds of issues that don't have specifically to do with slavery or even race, for that matter. So that's the broadening. I think it's also still branching. Best example of that is that there's more and more stuff being published on the Cormoran Strike series, and I think that'll be a huge area for growth. And finally, some works, you know, coming on other works by Rowling that haven't really gotten a lot of attention previously.
Right. You point out that she's just been a writing machine, and there's just so much. There's always more to think about and talk about, and she's adding to the Harry Potter universe, as well as creating other universes that invite comparison and, you know, thoughts about, you know, if we juxtapose these, you know, what do we see as maybe similarities, differences, divergences? And it all is just, you know, it just, it's good for thinking with, I think. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Her literary output has been astounding, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we also ought to talk about what we call the hippogriff in the room, because it's not just her literary output that has changed the landscape, but it is her, the change in her reputation and the way that her actions and her public speech has really defied people's expectations and
the tweets.
The tweet storm,
oh, the tweets,
Tweetgate, whatever. So how, let's talk about that. How has that caused Harry Potter scholarship to, you know, retract at all? Or has it, what's been the effect?
Well, first of all, nod to Beth Sutton Ramspeck for that phrase, the hippogriff in the room, because it's great. And I really love that particular description of it. I think it could quite easily have had a chilling effect. And I think about the best example I can cite is what happened to Cecilia Contrafar, who's also well known in Harry Potter studies. Cecilia was approached, I think, initially by the MLA, the Modern Language Association, and asked to put together an anthology of essays about teaching the Harry Potter series for a series that MLA has. She started working on that project, I think, in the summer of 2019. I had an essay that I was working on for that anthology. You probably did as well. And she worked on that project for 33 months. In December of 2021, she was having some correspondence with her editor. Drafts of all those essays had been written, and they were having some correspondence about what the external review process would involve. She was confident that that book was moving along, and that the result would be publication. And then suddenly in April, 4 months later, in April of 2022, she gets an email from somebody at the MLA indicating that the organization has withdrawn its support for the project. That's a couple of years after the axis shifting, as I describe it in the introduction. I contacted somebody in the at the MLA editorial offices. They were not willing to give me even a comment about that decision.
Surprise!
Cecilia yeah, did, right. You know, share with me the gist of that communication. I think their actual explanation had something to do with timeline, that they thought maybe another publisher could get that book out more quickly, or I don't know, something like that. But Cecilia's sense was very clearly that the MLA had decided it didn't want to be associated with projects concerning Harry Potter. In the 6 months or so after that, I confess that there were times when I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, wow, I wonder if anything is going to happen to this project. And if it does survive until publication, I wonder if anybody's going to read it. I mean, I wondered if people who had respect for me would think I should have abandoned the project. You know, I thought, I spent a lot of time thinking about all of that. In the end, a really important experience was going to the Chestnut Hill Conference. I think this may have been in the fall of 2019. And I remember hearing Lori Kim make a really impassioned statement that it was really important for those of us who'd been involved in Harry Potter studies to stay in. She was thinking about it from the perspective of perhaps generations later, that people would want to know what those of us who were really heavily involved in Harry Potter studies were thinking, what was on our minds, how were we, you know, dealing with the controversies that had arisen in relation to Rowling. I was persuaded by that, and I sent Lori a Facebook Messenger message one night and said, can I please quote these lovely things you said about the rationale for continuing in Harry Potter studies? So that turned out to be really important to me. Interestingly, I think there's been a kind of I'm not going to say rebirth, but I think there's been an interest in Harry Potter scholarship. When I think about all the books that have come out over just the last few years, and granted, some of those, like Cecilia's book Open at the Close, which is a different project, some of those were already in progress at the time of Tweetgate or whatever we want to call it. But in 2000, when I put out the call for proposals for the very first Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, I believe I got something like 3 dozen proposals for those. I ended up choosing 16 essays. In 2015, when we were working on the Critical Insights volume, Critical Insights Harry Potter, I think we got about 20 proposals for that, and we chose 14 essays. That was a whole lot easier than having 36 proposals and choosing 16 essays that were going to go in the book. So again, I got about 36 proposals in 2000, about 20 when we were working on, it was probably around 2013 when I started working on that project. I got, I believe, 33 this time around for the Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond. What that tells me is that maybe there was a little bit of a lull after, I think there was a flurry right after the last book in the series was published when people could be a little more confident, about the direction that the plot was going to take and resolution and all of that kind of thing. But I think there may have been a lull in the mid-teens. And I think if anything, there's been kind of a resurgence after the controversies, starting with Rowling in,
Right. Yeah, I think that I think that's not bad. I mean, I think that the probably as you said, there's like a lull when the series seemed to be ending, and you probably had this flurry and then people are like, "Well, what's next?" And then there were some other things that started to come out and maybe we saw a little uptick. And then there was all this controversy and it does drive you back into the material. It makes you look at it again, maybe with slightly different eyes. Bringing different perspectives to bear. I don't necessarily think it's wonderful to idolize an author, to the point where you're just, worshipful and everything they do and say must be great. I actually think it's much better for criticism if we have a little skepticism, So I think to me, it's a perhaps a healthy like renaissance that we're seeing.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's a good point, Katie. And I'm not sure in that way that the controversy was not maybe a little bit of a corrective. There may have been a little bit of an over-adulation of Rowling on the part of some people. And I think there were also folks who maybe had a couple of essays in them about the Harry Potter series, and then they stopped and they didn't resume, either because they, got involved in something else or because they became more interested in Cormorant Strike or for some other reason.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Emily, let's get into some of the chapters themselves. And Emily has a chapter in the Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond.
I
What's your
do.
chapter about, Emily?
Well, I was so excited to be included in it, because I really wanted to write this chapter, and I wanted to write about parenting. And I'm just gonna throw this at Amy H. Sturgis. Folks know Amy H. Sturgis. She's great. She's just a good friend of all of us and a co-collaborator. But she said something one time. I took her course, Harry Potter, Taking Harry Seriously, or something. It was with Signum University, and I took her course, and she said of the epilogue. She said she doesn't like the epilogue, and she was very sort of dismissive of the epilogue. And she said, everybody just goes and has a bunch of children, and it's just like, bah, and then they all lived happily ever after. And I was like, oh, I like the epilogue. I'm usually, these critical insights are sometimes because you're like, somebody says something, and you're like, oh no, I don't agree with that. I don't know why I don't agree with that, but I'm gonna find out, So, and that kind of dovetailed with something. Another, Leonie Caldicott wrote a this. She's a Catholic scholar. Like, I don't know, she's maybe even like an ethicist or something. But she wrote this essay or gave a speech or something, and I got a hold of a transcript of it. And she had said something to the effect of, she was comparing Voldemort's Horcruxes to the number of Weasley children. She pointed out the fact that Voldemort has the same number of Horcruxes as the Weasleys have children. And she kind of drew this very kind of quick, sort of not really her point, and moved on quickly, this comparison between their kind of methods of immortality. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, that's so cool, right? And so I just got to thinking of that. And then, of course, my own experience of parenting, that's always, I don't know, for me at least, it's been, I'm sure for you both as well, it's a very reflective thing to do, to become a parent. You think differently. The world is a totally different place, right? And so after you're a parent, and so I thought about all these things, And then I got into Louise Freeman actually helped me because Louise is a psychologist, and she kind of pointed me toward this sort of fourfold schema of like parenting models. And this has been, you know, this has been pretty established since, I would say, like the late 1960s, mid 1960s in psychology. And really people keep trying to improve this schema of these four models of parenting, and no one, people kind of maybe add a few things to it, but it's kind of really holding throughout, you know, the field. And so I was able to use these to sort of illustrate the different parenting styles in the very various Harry Potter characters. You know, so Harry and Dudley are parented by the same people, but in vastly different ways. So that becomes very interesting to see that Harry is like, he's parented in this very, you know, authoritarian way by the Dursleys, and yet the Dursleys parent their own son in this very indulgent way. And so to see the different child outcomes from that, and how they match the sort of textbook expectations for those child outcomes, is really fun to sort of illustrate. You know, so I kind of went through, so like Draco Malfoy is also, you know, permissive, indulgent. So, you know, when Lana said he was going to be asked to do something, you know, very important, but then not be able to do it, I was like, well, kind of goes with bad parenting outcome. You know, they're too dependent. They really can't rely on themselves because they're indulged too much. So, but then, you know, I'm a religious studies scholar. So there was part of me that was saying, you know, I can't really just leave this at Harry was parented by the Dursleys, because he wasn't really parented by the Dursleys. You know, he was parented, and he wasn't parented by James and Lily either, unfortunately. But Lily is this lasting presence in his life, and she sort of hovers over him, him being the Christ figure that he is in many Christian readings of the story. You know, she sort of hovers over his life like the figure of Mary, you know, in Catholicism. So there's a lot of Marian parallels and stuff. And so, but then his operative father is really Dumbledore. And so, and then, you know, that I relied on a really great essay that talked about the struggle, you know, the struggle that Harry has to believe Dumbledore and to sort of rely on what Dumbledore asked of him, even without the faith and, you know, without the surety of knowing how the things are going to come out, you know, is a metaphor for the challenge to have faith in God in both, you know, Christian and Hebrew scriptures, the struggle to have faith in God, despite that you don't know, you know, how things are going to turn out. You just have to trust God, right? And so it became this kind of interesting, you know, kind of, I feel a little bit like the essay is a little bit like, this is a psychology essay. No, wait, it's a religious studies essay. But
that's classic Emily Strand right there.
I know, right?
The beauty of it is we don't have to choose which of those it is.
Yeah. Right?
Exactly. Well, I mean, and I think that, you know, psychology and religious studies have always kind of sometimes struggled with each other and sometimes gone hand in hand. And so maybe that's appropriate. So, yeah. But I don't know how it represents the progression of Potter studies. I definitely think it stretched me, because I mean, I'm writing in the field of psychology, and but I had really great support and help both with Lana, but then also with Louise was a reader for me of the essay, and had helped keep me on track and make sure that I was getting the psychology part of it right and everything. So it was just a real delight to create and a delight to edit and try to get ready for the essay. And it's lovely to see it in print. So.
Yeah. And I think I was thinking about like the interdisciplinary nature of what you're doing. You're looking at Harry Potter parenting, and you're not just looking at it from one disciplinary perspective, but you're able to look at it from different ones. And then you find different parents when you look at it from
right.
different ones, and you
yeah.
can bring that together in the one article. And you have to have some background, right? You have to have these other people who have written about Harry Potter here and there, on whose ideas you can build. And I know, Lana, that's something that you had told all of us. You're like, make sure you are referencing the past and current scholarship on Harry Potter, because there's a lot of it. And sometimes people don't acknowledge that there is a lot. And that's, you know, one of the strengths of this volume. But also, I think that your essay really demonstrates that very well, Emily.
Thank you very much. Katie, you have an essay in the book as well. Tell us about your essay.
Yes. Well, first, I just want to say, I was thinking about this as I was preparing for this podcast. Like, what would my 2002, 2003 self think about the fact that I was in the second volume, like 20 years on,
right,
of
Rockstar.
The first Harry Potter anthology that I used to research? I would have just, there's just nothing better. Like, and that I know Lana Whited, and I'm just excited for myself, you know?
Also, Katie, don't look now, but we're on a podcast.
I know. It's amazing. And I think, you know, I think it's helpful to be able to, you know, like, what would my younger self have thought? And my younger self would have thought this was seriously like the coolest thing ever. What a great trajectory for myself. And so I'm just so thrilled to have been a part of the second volume of this, and especially considering, you know, the role of that, the first volume in my own development as a Harry Potter scholar of foundation even. And so this one, this essay is about history. So it's playing some to my own disciplinary strength. And I just got really interested in the Pottermore essays that J.K. Rowling was putting up on her on the Pottermore site that is now Wizarding World. And these essays are now included in what's called the J.K. Rowling Archive, which, what better historical name can you have than that also? And my interest in it was really for all the little glimpses of backstory that you get. And I've been interested for a long time in how terribly history of magic is represented. Like, history is a discipline in the books. It's awful, and nobody's interested in it, and is taught by this totally boring ghost teacher who doesn't even know the students are there. And it's just not a great representation of historical pedagogy. But then J.K. Rowling is obviously very interested in the history of this world. And of course, we know that things like the... The heir of Slytherin comes back, and the Chamber of Secrets is actually like a historical thing that they really, it would be helpful if they'd known more about it. And, you know, past traumas are still with the wizarding community. And so there's all this interesting stuff. But in these like extra little vignettes where she would talk about, like, you know, Platform 9 3/4 or the Hogwarts Express, she was giving you little glimpses of history. She calls them ghost plots. But my argument in this essay is that they are really little tiny histories. She is a genre parodist, and she is parodying the historical genre when she writes these histories. And that's part of what's fun about them, is it gives you this little feeling of, I'm reading like the Encyclopedia Britannica entry on the Hogwarts Express or what have you. And so it's kind of fun. But there are also lots of really important themes that come through. And she's drawing really clear historical parallels to European history that I think are fun to notice. So my chapter is called Secrecy and Segregation in the Wizarding World's Hidden Histories. These are the kind of things that are lurking in the background that you don't know when you're reading the books, but then you can see as she's bringing them out. And it's very much about the secrecy of wizarding society and how they were sort of driven to separate and also to go underground. And then the effect of that on these parallel experiences that they're having with things like, you know, scientific racism and the world wars. And like, these are things that don't just affect muggles or magical people. They're really affecting both of them. But then it also, like, then she came out with her History of North America series, which was so not yeah. well received. How about I'll put it that way. It was not well received. And it showed she was, first of all, much better with the understanding of European history than she was with American history and American geography. Some of that geographic stuff, I think it's hilarious, like how little sense it makes. But when she's doing this History of North America series, she's actually saying a lot of really important things about this, like, magical community in colonized North America and its relationship with the Native American people there. And she's not really conscious of the colonizing process that she has engaged in a literary sense, when she kind of replicates this historical voice of colonizing, you know, historians like she does in her Pottermore or Wizarding World essays. And so I talk about this in relation to what's called ornamentalist imperialism, where the colonizing country works to create kind of even like a more vivid and ritualized version of itself in the colonized country. And I think J.K. Rowling is actually doing that in a literary way in this completely imagined realm of the, you know, the nomadges coming in and colonizing North America. And she's just colonized North America all over again. And it's a little blind spot that she has that I think is really important. And it implicates the historical genre of writing, because there's been a real question among historians. Can we write history the way we write history in the West without really othering non-European peoples? You know, is this like a neutral way of expressing the past, or is it distinctively, you know, ethnocentric and consistent with just the way Europeans think about the past? And she has just kind of blindly stumbled into all of that in ways that I think are really interesting and make us think about the series and about also things like the Fantastic Beasts series and everything in a way that I hope is new and revelatory. And where I see the development and change there is, first of all, we have this new information, these backstories that she published, the ghost plots. But then also, I think what I tried to do was show how, you know, she's trying to do all the things that we think are good, right, in line with the good vision of, you know, like showing the problems that come when a population are marginalized and sent underground. But then she's also showing, oh, yeah, you can still be colonialist, like unconsciously, and still think you still have those very liberal values. And I think that's really worthwhile to understand that those two attitudes can reside in the same author and in the same work.
It's a cautionary tale.
Yeah. And yeah. I think another example of that, you know, I think Rowling is fundamentally a classicist, maybe a neoclassicist. And I wonder, I was having a conversation recently because Rowling had another kind of long diatribe about gender and gender identity on her, whatever Twitter is now, this week. And I was talking to Catherine Grimes about that. And Catherine was saying she wonders, you know, on a certain level, neither of us really believes that Rowling is really a deeply prejudiced person. I know there are people who disagree with that. That's not to say she didn't behave really badly, but, you know, Catherine was saying that some of her inability, some of her continuing to harp on the definition of the word woman seems like a very classical kind of approach to defining terms, and a kind of a, it reflects some of the inflexibility of the classical approach, I think, as though a word sort of has this fixed meaning and it can't change. It's almost a complete and total rejection of postmodernism with the idea that language changes as experience changes.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I think so too.
Yeah, I think all of this is really interesting. And one of the things that we've been talking a little bit about, Lana, is you've got your own essay in the book about, you know, one of these other forms of writing that she's engaged with, which was the serialized children's story, The Ichabod, that came out at the same time that reached its kind of crisis peak in the summer of 2020. And you really engaged with this story, The Ichabod. And in some ways, it shows some mix of thinking on her part as well.
I think it definitely does. It, as you know, was released in serialized form on Rowling's website starting in May 2020 as a sort of gift from Rowling to children who had to stay home from school. And yeah, and what's interesting to me about that, I think because of the controversies going on at that time, a lot of people kind of stopped reading Rowling at that point. I talked to a lot of people who have been pretty deeply enmeshed in Harry Potter studies who've never read The Ichabod. I love The Ichabod. It's probably my second favorite of Rowling's works after the Harry Potter series. And it's deeply interesting to me that in that little book-length fairy tale, Rowling creates a creature who's gender fluid, who has iterations that are both feminine and masculine, that has a kind of origin song like the Hogwarts Sorting Hat's origin song that kind of explains the evolution of Ichabod's through history. That some Ichabods are fierce and have to be very carefully controlled and managed, and others are very gentle. They're mushroom eaters, you know, for God's sake, even though the children who were raised in this realm are taught to fear them. You know, I think I could take most of what you just said about Rowling's maybe not being completely aware of what she's written and the attitudes that she's espoused. I think I could just transfer that to the experience of the Ichabod, Katie. And maybe I will.
Right. And I also really like you engage with the Ichabod as a story about monsters.
I do.
And monsters imagined and real monsters, you know, that are like violent boogeymen, but also violent politicians. And you put it in this context of other fairy tales and fairy tale monsters in a way that I think is really interesting and eye-opening. And I hope people will, you know, yeah, will engage with it. I think the Ichabod is a very interesting little parable in a way.
I would agree with that. And I think also that it is a good sort of an allegory for what was going on in U.S. politics, at least at the time of the pandemic and at the time that series emerged. You know, the notion of being in the hands of someone who didn't seem to have concern about what happened to the people of the realm, you know, all of that really resonated with me at that time.
Yeah, and I liked it's not a very obvious story in the sense it's not simplistic, and its resolution is maybe a little different than what people might expect. There's, you know, kind of complex redemption and some punishment, but not all the punishment, maybe. And so it does seem like it's a maturing story for young people.
I would agree with that. And I think everything you said about Rowling as a genre parodist also applies to what she's doing with the fairy tale in that particular book, because I thought a lot about The Emperor's New Clothes when I was reading that, largely because of Fred the Fearless's obsession with his wardrobe and, you know, his costumers. But I think there's a sense in which Rowling is also kind of parodying the genre of the fairy tale.
Sure. Yeah. And we've talked some on this podcast about some of the tales of Beetle the Bard. And I know that you have an essay in the volume about the Fountain of Fair Fortune, literary alchemy that Chris Swank did. That's very cool. So just, you know, listeners, there's a lot of cool stuff in here.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And tell us about other essays, Lana, that you'd like to highlight that are in the volume.
That's a tough question because it's hard for me to really single anybody out, but I am particularly proud of the fact that there are five or six essays by relatively new scholars, some of whom were still working on doctorates, one of whom is still working on a doctorate, actually, and one of whom was earning a master's degree at Kansas State. She was, that's Molly Bird, who wrote the essay about hybridity. Her essay was recommended to me by Karen Westman, who has an essay in the first Ivory Tower and Harry Potter. So, you know, there's kind of another connection to that anthology. But all of these folks who are, for most of them, this is their debut in Harry Potter studies with published work. Mitchell Parks, I mentioned Alyssa Lowry earlier, Madison McLeod, Catherine Olver, Molly Burt, who, as I mentioned, wrote the essay on hybridity, and Carsten Coleman, who wrote about the Fantastic Beasts series. All of that is not out of place in the company of essays by people like you guys and Bea Groves and John Granger and, you know, people who've done a lot of writing about Harry Potter studies. It's not as though you could pick out the work by the people with less experience in academic scholarship. And I'm really proud of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's all very, very good, consistent, high quality scholarship there. And one of the things that I like about it is that you actually did take on the beyond portion, you know, and we've talked about the Ichabod and, then, you know, I looked at some stuff that, is really beyond a little beyond, but you also, as you say, you have essays on Fantastic Beasts. And Emily is talking about parenting also in The Cursed Child. So there, and then also you have a discussion of Cormoran Strike, her next series. So there are lots of, you know, lots of good discussions of the beyond. And I wondered if, as you were thinking about those various works that are, you know, that are not just exactly the Harry Potter series, going a little bit beyond, you know, these other things that Rowling has been writing. Do you think that, how much continuity do you think there is there with the, you know, the Harry Potter series and the things that people initially fell in love with? And, you know, is the study of this literature going to be similar to the Harry Potter studies stuff, or is it going to be its own thing?
Obviously, there's a continuity between the Harry Potter series and the Fantastic Beasts series. Rowling first mentions Grindelwald pretty early in Sorcerer's Stone in the context of that chocolate frog card. In addition, you mentioned John Granger's essay. It is specifically about the fourth book in the Harry Potter series and the fourth book in the Cormoran Strike series, and the way that each of those serves as a kind of what John calls a latch in the overall architecture of those series. So all of those essays have continuity, I think, with other things. My own essay in talking about monsters and monstrosity in the Ichabod, I really start out by talking about the importance of monsters and creatures and beasts in the Harry Potter series, the fact that one of the Hogwarts subjects is Care of Magical Creatures, and that the Fantastic Beasts series is an outgrowth of the Harry Potter series. So, you know, other than perhaps Catherine Grimes' essay about The Casual Vacancy, which deals with that novel from the standpoint of social realism, I'm not sure any of those other essays does not intersect with the Harry Potter series. I failed to mention B. Grove's essay, and it is about the figure of the Naga, about Nagini, and how that particular mythological figure is sort of is continuity between the Harry Potter series and the Fantastic Beasts series, and the way that that figure is presented. That intersects with the French folktale about Melusine, which also shows up in A.S. Byatt's novel, Possession. That was a whole kind of set of folklore that I was unaware of and spent a fair amount of time reading about just because I got so interested in B's essay. But as I said before, you know, I think Catherine's essay may be the only one of those, and there's seven that deal with works other than the Harry Potter series. I believe Catherine's is the only one that maybe doesn't have a point of intersection, an obvious point of intersection with the Harry Potter series. Although I will say that her thesis in that essay begins with the point that the Harry Potter series has a clear and definite hero, and that one of the interesting things about The Casual Vacancy as a novel is that it really begins with the disappearance of the so-called hero, the death of Barry Fairbrother. So I suppose that's a point of intersection.
Yeah, I like, you make the point, I think that, or she makes the point that The Casual Vacancy is like, maybe it's our vacant hero spot. Right. Maybe that's the vacancy that we're looking at.
The vacant chair where the hero should sit.
So, Lana, while we have you, what's the future hold? What look into your, be Trelawney for a second, and look for, tell us about what future directions you see for Potter studies and beyond. And do you have any projects that you're pursuing? We know you like to start the next thing before the last thing is done. So tell us about the next things.
I will say that in terms of books, I am not working on a thing right now, although I did start a novel last spring during my sabbatical.
Oh, and
I
fun.
Guess the project I'm most interested in right now, it is not fantasy. I don't know that Trelawney is the best model for that,
no.
Emily.
No, maybe not. Maybe not.
For predictions, right. But I think that does have intersection with this question, because I will say, I keep reaching the point that I think, I love going to the Chestnut Hill Festival, and I plan to continue to do that. But every year I think, okay, next year I'm not going to send a proposal. I'm not going to give a talk. I'm just going to go, and I'm going to have a good time, and I'm going to listen to all the other interesting talks. And then at some point, usually during the winter, I get an idea, and the idea won't get out of my head.
Yeah.
And the idea that won't get out of my head right now, in fact, I already did a little bit of writing about it to make sure I don't forget it, happened during my Macbeth experience, when in Act 1, Scene 3, I think, after Macbeth has encountered the witches for the first time, and they've, you know, hailed him as the Thane of Cawdor, given him these, you know, titles, He says to Banquo, maybe chance will crown me without my stir. In other words, maybe I don't have to do anything. Maybe this is just going to happen and we can watch it play out. And yet Macbeth's tragedy is that he doesn't leave that alone. He doesn't really decide to wait and see what chance does. He decides he better nudge it along a little bit, you know, better safe than sorry, I suppose. And I remember in one of the rehearsals, I was playing a witch in Macbeth. I was off stage at that point, but I remember thinking, huh, that's just like Voldemort. You know, it's just like the idea of hearing that prophecy and deciding, I better get involved in this, and I'm going to assume this prophecy applies to Harry Potter, and that means I have to do A, B, C, D, and there goes a whole chain of consequences, right, from that decision to get involved. And I began to think about the fact that I don't know that there's been a lot of work done on the topic of prophecy in the Harry Potter series. And I think I started thinking about the way prophecy applies in some other hero myths, like the story of Arthur, for example, and the idea that, you know, Uther Pendragon had this dream. Started thinking about that. And the next thing I knew, I was writing a proposal. So it seems to always happen. You know, I may have some new ideas. I will say I don't have any more book length ideas. In terms of where scholarship about Rowling is going to go, I think, I hope, is I think that there's going to be a lot more work on the Cormoran Strike series. I think The Running Grave is probably the best novel in that series. I liked it very much. Louise and I have had some conversations about that. I've already encouraged Louise to edit an anthology because she's doing, I think, maybe some of the best work, maybe the best work.
She's good at predictions and stuff on that in that series too.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I should have said this when we talked about how scholarship has changed. Blogs, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe I forgot to say that. There's been so much really good, high quality scholarship on Hogwarts Professor, where Emily, you were writing for a while, and on the blog that Louise has now, and, you know, other people who are blogging about that. So I said to Louise, you really ought to think about editing an anthology of essays about Cormoran Strike series. And she said, I'll do that if you'll write an essay about true crime connections with the crimes that occur, because there are some. And you know, it's funny. I mean, it kind of takes me back to the beginning of this whole process, because in probably late 1999, right before I bought the first two Harry Potter books for my nephews as a Christmas present, I was thinking of myself primarily as a nonfiction scholar. I'd written a dissertation about true crime novels. I was in the process of trying to turn that into a book at the time. I'd had really good interaction with an editor at a conference about that and was working on that project. And suddenly Harry Potter kind of fell into my lap, and I decided, well, I'll write an essay about this. And, you know, when I went to give the presentation about that essay, suddenly I came up with this idea for a book project. I think about what you guys have said, what you said a few minutes ago, Katie, about thinking back to who you were in 2000 and looking ahead. You know, when I think about where I was at that point, would I have predicted that the three of us would be doing a podcast in 2024 and talking about my 25-year career practically in Harry Potter studies, which frankly has completely taken over my professional reputation? I mean, I didn't finally get around to publishing that book about true crime novels, but frankly, it took me 40 years from the time that's literally true. Got the first idea. So I was thinking about all of that. And then last week I saw this little meme on Facebook about how apparently Miriam Margolyes, who of course played Professor Sprout,
right,
Head of my own house, said something to the effect of the fact that Harry Potter's a children's series and she really thinks adults should have let it go by now and like moved on to something else. And I'm thinking, no, Miriam, no.
She's probably not read it.
Right. Who the heck could have predicted
right
what has happened so far? So for that reason, I'm almost afraid to try to predict what might happen next. My sense is that where the Harry Potter novels themselves are concerned in terms of scholarship, I really think I'm almost done with it. I mean, I don't have some big idea in mind. I like kind of feeling like the grandmother of Harry Potter studies. I mean, if John Granger can be the dean of Harry Potter studies, I think I can be the grandmother. I think I have a pretty good claim there, especially when I think about, all these young scholars who are doing this really exciting work that I was able to get into this anthology. I think I can assure you that there will not be an ivory tower in Harry Potter 3. I mean, I think that is out of the question
So
at
you
this
say now, we'll see in 20
point.
years, Lana. We've
What
got
I
it on tape.
frankly am most looking forward to is the opportunity to read the Harry Potter books with my grandchildren. I mean, that's
Ah,
the next, really.
absolutely.
So.
Yeah, I love all these ideas. I want to read these papers that you're talking about, and I find it very amusing that you're reluctant to make predictions at the same time that you're contemplating an essay about prophecy and the danger of trying to hustle prophecies along. And I have my own thoughts about that, which I'll be happy to share with you as I was sort of listening to some things
As
about.
you had said very eloquently about Rowling herself, we probably are not in the best position
Right.
to analyze our own work and to
That's
talk about what it means. And,
right.
other people should probably do that.
Yes, indeed. Well, Lana, you have certainly given the Harry Potter scholarly community a great platform, and also you've done such amazing things yourself. And I totally agree with you. I always think I'm tapped out. I got nothing else, and then something else occurs to me that I think I could always talk about this. So that's great. And I look forward to seeing more from you on whatever topics you are interested in pursuing there. And so with that brings us to the end of our episode. So thank you very much, Dr. Lana Whited, for joining us on the show today.
Well, thank you. It's always fun, and I'm always delighted to talk about virtually anything at all with you guys.
I feel the same. Today, I'm going to end with a quote from Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, just sort of thinking a little bit about what we were talking about with Harry Potter anthologies. "And just look at these books," said Hermione excitedly, running a finger along the spines of the large leather-bound tomes. "A compendium of common curses and their counteractions. The dark arts outsmarted. Self-defense spell work. Wow!" She looked around at Harry, her face glowing, and he saw that the presence of hundreds of books had finally convinced Hermione that what they were doing was right. All these works of Harry Potter scholarship can't be wrong, my friends. Read up!
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
And until next time, class dismissed.